Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, the disease that affects about a third of the world's population and is becoming resistant to all of the agents that we can throw at it.
Once you're resistant to the second-line drugs, then it's very, very difficult to treat. We've even seen cases now being reported where what we're calling total drug resistance, where the bacteria are resistant to every single drug that's been tested on them so far.
Plus, scientists find fluorine seeping out of rocks in Germany, cyborg jellyfish, and sunsets on Mars. We ask, what colour are they?
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
Hello, welcome to September's Chemistry World Podcast. I'm Chris Smith, and with me this month to distill out some of the biggest and brightest breakthroughs in chemistry for you are Philip Robinson, Eleanor Richards, and Neil Withers. We kick off this month on Mars. There's been much fanfare about Curiosity, the rover that's there, but some scientists are saying that it's destined to fail to find life before it's even got started. Phil.
Back at the beginning of August, NASA landed a rover on the surface of Mars. Now that it's there, it's going about the job that it was designed to do, which is analysing the Martian surface and atmosphere. One of the things that it's going to be looking for is the presence of organic molecules.
With the idea being that this could be a hallmark of past life.
Well, exactly.
Or even present
exactly.
life, I suppose.
Possibly present life, but if it had at one time harboured life, then we might expect to see some of these organic molecules.
But isn't that what Curiosity is set up to do? It's got a laser that can zap rocks and then look at the gas plume that comes off. It's got a whole laboratory, an analytical laboratory inside it.
It has. It's incredibly high-tech. It's festooned with analytical instrumentation designed for exactly this purpose. However, there are those that say its mission in that respect is going to be a failure.
Why?
This isn't the first time that a rover has been to Mars, and it's not the first time that it's been there with the purpose of looking for these organics, and all previous attempts to do so have also failed.
Well, can I therefore be devil's advocate for a second and say, what if I just went to random bits of space where we don't think there's any life and never has been, You will find organic molecules because of chemistry going on around stars and just naturally in space. So they should have found something, surely.
Exactly. So there's a huge question here, which is that regardless of whether or not Mars has ever harboured any life, it should have organic material present on its surface.
Just well, so from, what you're saying, just from so you're, cosmic you're bombardment. Saying perhaps the analytical techniques themselves don't work.
That is one of the arguments for the reason, the failure to find these organic molecules. Sam Kunivas of Tufts University thinks what happens when the Martian soil has been analysed is that certain species that are present there called perchlorates oxidise these organic species and turn them into carbon dioxide. And that's why you don't see any of these organic molecules.
So we know the perchlorates are there?
We do know the perchlorates there. Yeah, that has been established.
So if he's right, is there a way around this?
So he's proposed his own solution, which is an alternative analytical device that, in fact, exploits the fact that perchlorate is present on the Martian soil and it will oxidise the organics. So in his analytical instrument, the sample of the Martian soil is fed into an electrolysis device where the perchlorate itself acts as the electrolyte and all of the organic material is oxidised to produce carbon dioxide and then you just detect the carbon dioxide. So that gives you a measure of the total amount of carbon. Obviously, it doesn't tell you in what form.
Is this something that can be reverse engineered into Curiosity, the present mission?
Unfortunately, it's too late for Curiosity, so it's a consideration for future missions.
They will still be able to detect minerals and things like that, won't they, which would have been an indicator of a very wet environment or certain temperatures, the kind of places where we know life flourishes on Earth today and where we think it evolved.
Yeah, that's what they're really out there looking for, is places where life might have been able to survive or have originated.
Let's move off of Mars and back to Earth, because something which was always taught in my chemistry lessons, Neil, was that fluorine, this Tyrannosaurus rex oxidising element, does not exist as F2 in gaseous form on Earth because it's just too reactive. And now you're going to blow this out of the water.
I'm afraid I'm going to ruin all the preconceptions about fluorine, elemental fluorine on Earth, as you have them, because Florian Krauss from Munich He was intrigued by stories that he, when he was researching his inorganic fluorine class that he was going to teach, that a mineral known as fetid fluorite contains some fluorine gas. Fetid, because the smell, people thought, might be fluorine. But the thing was, the geologists weren't sure if the smell was fluorine or whether it was something else.
So when you say smell, people were literally sniffing bits of rock.
Yeah, so when you break this mineral, fetid fluorite or antozonite, it releases a very characteristic smell, which is quite unpleasant.
And people wondered, is this...
Is this fluorine?
Because they knew there was fluoride in the rock, so there was a sort of leap of faith.
This is a calcium fluorite, CaF2 mineral, so there is fluorine in some form. But he, as a fluorine chemist, thought he had a good chance of being able to identify it, so he found out where he could find some of these rocks.
Which is where?
Which is in Wilsendorf in Germany, so he just drove
there. Down the road?
Just down the road for him. So he drove there, picked up some rocks, and took them back to his lab. He smashed them with a hammer, and he smelt the characteristic smell.
How does he know that's fluorine, though?
Well, he then compared that by smelling fluorine gas itself.
He really smelled fluorine, but I thought it was really toxic.
Well, I spoke to him, and he said that in very low concentrations and very briefly, it is safe. And the smell of fluorine is so characteristic that he was absolutely sure that it had to be fluorine.
This is a man after Humphrey Davy's heart, isn't it? Because he was famous for sniffing things, including Entonox, but that's a different story. So he reckons on the basis of his own olfaction, this is fluorine coming out of this rock. So how did he prove it?
So he tried to prove it with a mass spectrometer, but he thinks that the fluorine gas was so reactive it was reacting with parts of the spectrometer before it could get to the detector. So he was a bit disheartened that it wasn't working. But fortunately, he was talking to one of his colleagues over a social evening of beer and pretzels at a symposium, and his colleague works on solid-state NMR. So he persuaded his colleague to put a small sample of the actual rock itself, so not the gas, into his NMR machine, and they saw a characteristic chemical shift that showed that it is fluorine gas. So the shift is...
So where did it come from?
It turns out that antozonite has a small amount of uranium in, which is, of course, radioactive. So the beta decay from uranium and from the daughter nuclides causes some of the fluoride anions in the lattice to kind of become dislodged. After a bit of a mess, you end up with two fluorine atoms coming together to form fluorine F2, as we know it. And they even observe some bubbles the size of, I think, 200 nanometers using an electron microscope.
Thank you, Neil. And now to a scourge that has infected one person in every three, and during the time it takes you to listen to this programme, it will kill over 300 people. But why is TB such a problem, for whom and where?
My name is Ruth McNerney. I work at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine as a senior lecturer doing research. I'm also an advisor and a trustee of the UK charity for tuberculosis, TB Alert. There's about 9 million new cases every year of TB. We have a problem in about 3 million of those we think are not diagnosed. So we're talking about estimates. And we're talking about 1.5 million people every year dying from tuberculosis.
So we're on the scale of HIV in terms of new cases a day, people dying a day. It's about 10,000 then.
It's interesting. HIV, it's a very closely related disease to TB. The two run together, really. Most people who die from AIDS, which is the HIV disease, they're dying of tuberculosis.
So, in other words, geographically, are we seeing a massive overlap?
First and foremost, TB is a disease of poverty. It's in the part of the world where people are poor, where they're malnourished, but it's also where the HIV is. So though the most number of cases are in India and China, because that's where the most people live, in terms of the proportion of cases, it's South Africa, Southern Africa, Zambia, Zimbabwe, all over Africa. Wherever you find HIV, you find a huge problem of TB.
If you look at some Victorian literature, though, and you read a bit of Dickens and a few others, there are people dying of consumption, in inverted commas, as it was then known. They didn't have HIV, though. So what happened here? So it was rife and now isn't, and it is still rife in other bits of the world then?
Well, there's lots of contributing factors. It's a lot of to do with to do with improving social conditions. People were eating better. Eventually, we got drugs. But it's interesting that the cases came down very dramatically in Europe as lifestyles got better, as people got richer. So it's very much around people's lifestyles, the pressures they're under, the way they live their lives, overcrowding, diabetes is a risk factor, smoking is a risk factor. And now, of course, we've got HIV as this huge risk factor in Africa.
What actually is the problem now? Because we had got the numbers down here in Britain to really low levels. Now they're going back up again. So are we reverting to the Victorian era, or is something else driving this recurrence?
One of the problems we are facing is development of drug resistance, and it's emerging all over the world, drug resistance. It's not a huge problem in the UK yet, but in other parts of the world it really is. We use a cocktail of drugs for TB, and you have to treat for months. 6 months is the shortest treatment for TB, and often it goes on for longer than that. And if those drugs fail, then you don't get treated. You stay infectious, because TB spreads when people cough. They're coughing out the bacteria into the air. So if you can't treat people, they stay infectious and they stay spreading the disease. So we've got two problems. One is a lot of the people we don't detect. Some people don't realise they're sick, and they do realise they're sick. They've got a cough. They eventually think they've got a cough that needs looking at. The tests aren't very good for actually detecting disease. And so a lot of people we miss and don't get onto treatment early. The other big problem is if they've got drug-resistant TB, we put them on the standard drugs and they don't get better and they continue to transmit. The
reason why are those treatments so long? Why are people having to take 6 months of therapy when if you get a sort of splinter in your finger and a bad infection at the end of your finger under your fingernail, it's a week of flucloxacillin and you're better?
Well, TB is a very interesting bacteria. It's kind of, it co-evolves with humans. It's very unusual. It grows much more slowly than most other bacteria. Other bacteria like E. coli, they double every 15 minutes. It takes literally all day, like 20 hours, for TB to double. And it can just sit there and do nothing. It's resistant to a lot of antibiotics. They just can't get inside the bacteria to do any damage. It's resistant to most disinfectants as well. And so it's actually very difficult to kill. You can have drugs that will kill it when it's actively growing, but if it's just sitting there and it sits inside organs, inside cells, so it's quite hard for the drugs to actually find where the bacteria, it can just sit there. And if it's not growing, most of the drugs can't really kill it.
It gets inside cells, that's where it grows.
TB disease is actually this sort of battle between the immune system and the bacteria. It gets into the lungs, and then it gets the immune system recognises it and gets to work, but it's not effective. It's a horrendous problem. We don't understand why some people develop the disease, some don't. We think about a third of the world's population, like 2 billion people, have been affected by TB, but only about 10 or 15% actually develop the disease. And we just don't understand why some people are susceptible.
Now, when you say that a third of the world population, quite literally more than 2 billion people, could have been infected with TB, does that mean they're infected and they stay infected and that it can come back in them, or does it mean that they have cleared the infection?
It probably means both. We don't really understand. Certainly you can be exposed to TB and not develop a noticeable disease, and then 30 years later you can develop TB. Some people may clear the disease completely.
Now, looking at the way we treat it, if you take drugs for 6 months to clear it, obviously the compliance is going to be quite poor among patients for that. Does that lead to resistance?
Yes, it's one of the big factors in resistance.
What fraction of the TB that's now circulating, if you were to put people on the standard regime that we would give someone who turned up in the hospital here, what fraction wouldn't respond now?
It varies around the world. Somewhere like the UK, the rate of drug resistance is very low. There are other parts of the world, like Moldova, over half the patients have got multi-drug resistant TB. Of new cases, people have never been treated before. We think between 3 and 4% of them have multi-drug resistant TB.
And although it's multi-drug resistant, it's still treatable, is it?
It is, yes. We define multi-drug resistance as being resistance to two of the major drugs, isoniazid and rifampicin. And if you're resistant to those drugs, you're likely to fail treatment. You should change to a new treatment. The new treatments, the separate treatments there, there's several problems. One is they're very expensive drugs. But another big problem is they're actually very toxic. So the side effects are really unpleasant for people. A lot of nausea. So they are difficult to take. And the problem is then also we've got resistance to those drugs. And once you're resistant to the second-line drugs, then I'm afraid it's very, very difficult to treat. We've even seen cases now being reported where what we're calling total drug resistance, where the bacteria resistant to every single drug that's been tested on them so far.
What can we do about it? And why are there so few drugs that will tackle TB, really? I mean, it's been around for donkey's years. I would have thought it was one of those things that was really easy to deal with.
Well, there's lots of reasons. One is the lack of political will. We thought TB was going away in the world. It wasn't a really big problem, so there wasn't much research. going into it. It's not a big money spinner, so drug companies are not going to put a lot of money in. So there is some research going on. There are some new drugs in the pipeline. But TB bacteria is a very, very challenging bug. And you've got this amazing cell wall that's very waxy, and to get the drugs in is quite difficult. So a lot of drugs just bounce off TB virtually. They don't work. Getting a compound that might work as the first step, that's kind of cheap. But then you've got to do very, very expensive studies just to see if they really work or not in the population. And they take years because TB takes that long to treat. And then you've got to follow up patient for years to see if they relapse and it comes back again. So it's a very big investment to get a new drug going.
Ruth McNerney from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And now, good news for needle phobics, potentially. Eleanor.
Well, diabetics need insulin injections every day. So insulin is produced by the pancreas and it allows cells to take up glucose from food to use for energy. So a lack of insulin leads to glucose build-up in the blood and this leads to diabetes. So injecting yourself with insulin can't be a pleasant experience. I've got needle phobia, so completely understand. So scientists have been trying to come up with a more pleasant way to take insulin.
Because you can't swallow it, of course, because rather like eating your egg in the morning with a lot of protein, it just breaks down in stomach acid, proteases and digestive juices.
That's it. Scientists have worked on getting it in an oral dose, but the concentration just gets reduced in the stomach. So now a group from Kyushu University in Japan, led by Masahiro Goto, have come up with a way of delivering it through the skin.
Wow, how?
Well, they've made capsules loaded with insulin, covered them in a peptide that's known for enhancing skin penetration, and then they disperse the capsules in an oil that also has a permeation enhancing effect.
What's the protein that gets it into the skin?
Well, the protein is oligoarginine. What they did was they first surrounded their insulin molecules with proteins, and then they coated these with hydrophobic surfactant. This forming a protein surfactant complex. Then they added the oligoarginine peptides on top of this and then dispersed the complexes in oil.
And then what, do you rub this on or you have a patch or something? How do they use it?
I think it's just rubbed onto the skin.
And how much goes through?
Well, they tested it on pig skin and found that it delivered 6 times more insulin into the skin than capsules in an aqueous solution. But we're not quite sure if that's enough of a dose.
Whether it's clinically relevant.
Yes.
Because obviously getting it through with a needle is very good. I mean, that's why people do it. But if you can only get a tiny amount through by shoving it on in a cream or a patch or something, it's not going to be terribly effective.
No, and I think that's something they need to look at.
If this enables things like proteins to go through skin, does that mean then that the same technology, regardless of whether it works for diabetes, could be used for other drugs or things that are protein-based that we want to get in?
Yes, the researchers do say that is their future plan. They want to produce a vaccine as well that could be delivered through the skin.
Which would be, again, good for your needle-phobic problem, I suppose.
Oh, yes.
All right, well, let's sort of blast off into outer space for a second because, Neil, you've got some interesting news for us on the question of neutron stars and the kind of chemistry that goes on there.
Absolutely. So neutron stars are incredibly dense. I think a neutron star about the size of the Earth would weigh half as much as the Sun, so they're incredibly dense, and they spin very quickly, and this generates incredibly strong magnetic fields that are 10,000, 100,000 Tesla, whereas the magnetic field in an NMR machine or an MRI that you might use in a hospital or the lab is around 1 Tesla. So these are incredibly strong magnetic fields.
So with that kind of power, in terms of the field effects, what would be the behaviour of various chemicals if
so
they
obviously,
were to just be added in that environment then?
So it's very hard for us to test this in the lab, for example, or we can't go to neutron stars. So a team from the University of Oslo have computationally looked at the behaviour of simple diatomics like dihydrogen and helium, and they found that if just promoting an electron to an antibonding orbital in dihydrogen, for example, that would normally be enough to tear apart the molecule because it's no longer energetically favourable. But they found that in these incredibly tense magnetic fields, the molecule would align itself perpendicular to the magnetic field, and the interaction between the antibonding orbital and the magnetic field would be enough to stabilise it so it wouldn't fall apart. So this kind of a magnetic bonding they've discovered that would be complementary to the normal electron bonding that we know, ionic and covalent and so on.
Is this chemically relevant, though? Is this likely to provoke or promote some kind of new chemistry to take place if atoms and molecules will behave in strange ways in these fields. Does this mean that other kinds of interactions are possible that wouldn't normally happen and that could lead to some new chemistry?
I think in terms of the discovery itself, I think the magnetic fields are so strong that it's very, very unlikely that it's ever going to be of practical use on Earth or even studied in the kind of glove boxes and strange environments that we can use.
But my point is more that if you can drive new kinds of chemistry, I don't mean necessarily here on Earth, but out in space, because of these interesting phenomena that we hadn't accounted for before.
I guess it could mean that in neutron stars there are other effects going on that we hadn't thought about. But I think that equally the kind of magnetic and high-pressure stuff would probably overcompensate for these relatively subtle magnetic effects.
I'm not sure if blue skies research is the right way to describe that, because it's not a blue sky, it's a neutron star. It's sort of whale white colour, isn't it?
Probably, yeah. I've not seen one.
You're listening to the Chemistry World podcast with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, new reasons to worry about ozone depletion and cyborg jellyfish. First, though, to a celebrated scientist who is also a worthy recipient of Chemistry World's Entrepreneur of the Year Award. He's pioneered the discovery of molecularly targeted cancer drugs. He's also a passionate proponent of personalised medicine and, so far, he's founded two successful chemical companies. We began by discussing why, and despite huge investment, cancer still remains largely uncured.
I'm Paul Workman, and I'm the head of cancer therapeutics at the Institute of Cancer Research in London. I think we've made, you know, incredible inroads. There are a number of leukemias, there are childhood cancers where patients are cured, there are breast cancer survivors that are surviving 20 years or more. But it's certainly true that we haven't made across the board the level of cures that we were aspiring to do. And the biggest problems are twofold. And those two issues are understanding the molecular basis of cancer so that we can come up with therapies that are more effective than the old one-size-fits-all cytotoxic drugs. And we're in the process of sorting that out now. And then the second one is the problem of drug resistance, which is certainly something that is a major problem.
Is the fact that we're getting better at interrogating cancers and understanding what the disease is the fact that it's now advancing a reflection on technology? Because we now have the ability to probe the genome in unprecedented detail, what we can do in a day took years, 10 years ago.
There's no question that the technology of genome sequencing and other large-scale profiling methods has and is revolutionizing everything that we do. What I would say is that over the last 3 or 4 decades, hypothesis-driven basic research and cancer research has laid the foundations for understanding the basic mechanisms and principles by which cells become malignant. So the discovery of oncogenes, the understanding of how oncogenes deregulate, and the first molecularly targeted therapies have come in general from more classical hypothesis-driven approaches. What, however, has happened in the last decade is just an unbelievable avalanche of data. And from that data, we've refined out the astonishing complexity of cancer. And of course, the whole of the cancer genome understanding has been built on the initial investment in the human genome sequence.
And will our same tools that are informing us about the pathogenesis of cancer, that also can apply clinically, can't it? Because a person can have their particular tumour or their particular genome sequenced and then monitored in order to best inform, best guide therapy.
Yes, absolutely. We are doing that now, and that will become increasingly common. So, you know, with the advent of next generation sequencing, deep sequencing, we're approaching the era of the $1,000 genome. So the ability to at least whole exome, if not whole genome sequence, the cancer cells from an individual patient is becoming as affordable as a PET scan. I mean, for some time we've been treating patients that have amplification of the ERBB2 gene with Herceptin. That's become standard of care for patients with that type of breast cancer. Last year we saw the approval of a BRAF inhibitor in melanoma for those patients that have a BRAF mutation, and for another drug for patients with ALK mutations or translocations in lung cancer. So that's got to be the way forward, to use the whole of the genome sequence in a way that will best allow us to personalize medicine for each individual patient and each individual tumor.
What about the drug pipeline? Is that looking in good state?
Yeah, well, the state of the pharma industry, the commercial situation, the recession, the inevitable risk aversion that has developed and conservatism that's developed in the industry with the demise of the blockbuster and the emergence of personalized medicines, which is where the science is taking us, but on the other hand is challenging the blockbuster model. All of these are difficult challenges for pharma to think about. Even with the fastest drug discovery technologies, it still will take 5 to 10 years to go from a discovered cancer gene to the regulatory approval of a new medicine. So the way I look at this is we're facing an incredible biological opportunity, and we're trying to tackle that with a somewhat out-of-date pharma model that's still rather slow, is risk-averse, and there is this innovation gap or valley of death between basic biological scientific discoveries. Now, the solution to this problem is the model that we've developed at our unit and institute, is to say it's now the job of non-profit groups, both funders and universities and research institutes, to move on from the notion that you would simply find a new drug target, publish it, and wait for the industry to develop it, but rather say, look, there is an innovation gap here. There is an incredible biological opportunity. If we can build a professional drug discovery group within a non-profit research institute environment, take on these high-risk targets, take them to a proof-of-concept level where industry will say, this is now looking more promising, and we think we can invest in this. And that's the model that we've taken, and we've had quite a bit of success, and we've now got several drugs that are coming through.
But who's paying for this? Because you can't get a drug company to invest in this because they're, as you put it, risk-averse.
Yeah.
In other words, they're looking after their shareholders.
Yeah.
Are you therefore just pushing the burden onto the taxpayer? Because basically the government are going to fund research which is risky but may have big gains, but there are no shareholders, so no one minds so much.
Well, that's one way of putting it. The way I would put it is that the taxpayer and the public wants to see cancer cured. We do get government funding. We also get a lot of funding from Cancer Research UK, which is a charitable body, and of course they in turn get their donations from the public, who are taxpayers. But when I talk to people out there, they want to see investment in breakthrough innovative drugs. I mean, we're never going to invest in doing a drug development project which we already know is going on in a pharmaceutical company. We're always going to be taking on the high-risk innovative research and thereby making breakthroughs, and of course publishing those breakthroughs. That's the other thing, that increasingly drug discovery research is an extension of basic research. So we, for example, will come up with chemical tools or probes that are able then to interrogate the biology and learn more about the biology of cancer. So it has a strong public benefit basic research or applied research angle. But what about the question of, as a result of public investment through charitable funding and government research, we come up with a new, as we have recently, you know, a new breakthrough therapy that's changed practice in prostate cancer, abiraterone. First of all, I think people with that disease and the public response to that has been, this is fantastic, and this is what you should be doing. There is, of course, an eventual benefit, which is that because we, being entrepreneurial, will partner that drug with a pharmaceutical company, and we will get some return on that through the licensing deal that we've done. So when we partner with a company, the main objective is to get that drug to patients as fast as possible. That's always our motivating factor. But of course, we will in due course get royalty payments and milestone payments. They will be reinvested in the research, and they'll go back to Cancer Research UK and back to our institute, and there'll be a cycle of renewed investment in research that will be autocatalytic.
Paul Workman. And now let's take a look skyward, where we might see a growing hole in the ozone layer. Phil.
Okay, so this story is to do with ozone depletion.
I thought the problem was going away. I thought the Montreal Protocol in the 1980s and the banning of CFCs, I thought the hole had stopped getting bigger and was shrinking.
That's right, that's right. You're right, Chris. The problem has become a lot less worse in recent years. The protocols you mentioned, these things have all reduced the concentration of chloride species in the stratosphere, and that's what really does the damage to the ozone levels in the stratosphere that protects us.
But now you're going to tell us we've missed something.
Well, now there's something else going on that we didn't know about before. Up till now, we've been familiar with the idea of ozone depletion taking place at the poles of our planet. But this research suggests that actually this could become a problem for more temperate zones, and particularly the more kind of highly populated land masses that exist at the sort of mid-latitude.
Yeah.
So we'll take it a step back and talk about the chemistry of ozone depletion. Like I said, the important species here that does the damage are chloride radicals. Now, almost all of the chlorine that exists in the stratosphere comes from chlorofluorocarbons that were used a lot in the 20th century, certainly. And that's the remnants of these chlorofluorocarbons still exist up there in the stratosphere, and they're now present as inorganic chlorine. So it's chlorine combined with various other inorganic elements. And there's a sort of a steady state balance between these inorganic chlorine species and the chlorine radicals that exist that really do the damage to ozone. Now, below a certain threshold temperature, that balance shifts towards the chloride radicals, and that's when it's bad news. Hmm. And that threshold temperature depends upon two things: the size of sulfate particles that exist in the stratosphere, and that's where these reactions occur that give rise to the chloride radicals, and also how much water vapour is present in the stratosphere at that level. And that's the point that that brings us to the research that's been conducted here by James Anderson at Harvard University.
Firstly, though, why is size important?
Well, obviously, the bigger the sulfate particles, there's a larger surface area for these reactions to take place.
And what have they found, this new group?
These researchers have found that hot, wet air during violent summer storms, the hot, wet air that these produce is carried far up into the stratosphere, which hadn't been thought to occur previously. Up till now, the accepted thinking was that this column of hot, wet air would go as far as the layer between the troposphere and the stratosphere, and then it would kind of dissipate. It would spread out at that point. But what these researchers have found, that in fact, that column goes right up into the stratosphere, carrying water with it up into that level, increasing the amount of water vapour present in the stratosphere and shifting that balance of inorganic and chloride radicals towards the chloride radicals.
Because, of course, it's cold up there as well, isn't it? That will give another key recipe ingredient here.
Yeah. So this is quite worrying, because this means that we could find ourselves with local ozone depletion in these areas where these storms are taking place.
So if we make the storms more violent and more frequent, we could be then seeing a positive feedback loop where we're going to damage more ozone.
Exactly. And that is another outcome of this research that suggests we may have a link, actually, between ozone depletion and climate change.
Well, from out of the sky and into the sea, scientists made a jellyfish that's, I would say, half human, but it's not half human, it's sort of half rat, half machine. What on earth is this?
Well, this weird creature, called the cyborg jellyfish, is the creation of researchers at the California Institute of Technology and Harvard University. So like you say, it's half biological and half synthetic, and it moves like a real jellyfish.
How big is it? Is it the same size as a real jellyfish, or are these tiny?
It's quite small. It's about 18 millimetres in diameter.
Oh, OK, and not too scary. No. Although Irukandji, that kills people in Australia, is about that big. So maybe that's a sort of false reassurance. So how have they done it?
What they've done is they've taken a flat disk of a silicon polymer with 8 lobes surrounding it, so it looks like a jellyfish already. And then on one side of the disk and the lobes, they've coated it with heart muscle cells from a rat. The whole purpose of this really is that, you know, it sounds like a bit of fun, but there is a serious side to it. They made the jellyfish to test new heart drugs.
Basically, the cells are sticking onto the silicon sheet.
Yes.
And because heart muscle cells have an intrinsic B to their own, and they all beat together. That's going to sort of impart a sort of almost like a heart-like type of movement to the jellyfish, and sort of looking like the way jellyfish swim.
Yes, that was the purpose. So what they did was they placed this jellyfish in water, exposed it to an electric field, and then the heart muscle cells contract. That forces the lobes downwards, driving the jellyfish forward. And then when the heart cells relax, the lobes go back to their original position. So that motion is like, you know, a heart pumping. It's a similar type of action. So what they're planning on doing is testing drugs that are designed to improve a sick heart's pumping action.
So you've got something to test it on. You can actually see the benefits. So rather than having to use a real heart or a real animal, you could you've made a fake heart that you can watch objectively.
Yeah.
Okay. Are they pretty sure that they can do this consistently, as in the cells all line up in the right way and all this kind of thing, to make sure that you're really comparing apples with apples each time?
Yes. So what they've said is that the coating of the heart muscle needs to replicate the precise pattern of muscle cells found in this particular jellyfish called Aurelia aurita. They use an algorithm that's commonly used by law enforcement agencies to quantify fingerprints to analyse the subcellular protein structures of the muscle cells. And then they made a map of where every muscle cell in the jellyfish was. And then they used this map to guide the coating of the rat muscle cells onto the polymer.
Although, I mean, that's a jellyfish, but that's not a heart, is it? So there's a difference between a heart and a jellyfish.
True.
Does that necessarily affect things?
They don't say that, but I mean, this is much cheaper than finding a whole heart.
No, indeed. Well, it's quite hard to connect hearts and jellyfish to our trivia for this month, but this one totally caught me out. Tell all, Neil.
Well, the question is, if the sky on Mars is red, what colour does it change at sunset?
Yeah, because, of course, on Earth, the sky is blue because the white light from the sun gets scattered by the nitrogen and oxygen molecules because the bond length is roughly the same size as the wavelength of blue light. So when we have a red sunset, we've got lots of bigger particles like dust and stuff in the atmosphere, which scatters more red out, so it looks red. So if Mars has got red light already, then it has to shift towards the sort of greeny-blue end of the spectrum then. So I would say green?
Well, it turns out it's blue. So
all the way to the blue end?
It's from the pictures we've seen, it does look pretty much blue. So, as you say, the sky here on Earth is blue because the nitrogen and oxygen are scattering blue light everywhere, so that's why we see blue when we look up. But when we look at a sunset, the light's coming from a much more shallow angle, and it's all the blue's already been scattered, so what's left is the kind of the red and orange, so we get those charismatic colours that we all know and love. And entirely the opposite is true on Mars. So the red light is scattered by the dust particles in the atmosphere when you're looking up, and so when you look across at a sunset on Mars, then all the red light's been scattered and you're left with just the blue.
How do we know that?
From pictures. From pictures taken by those wonderful rovers that they send up to Mars when they don't crash.
Excellent. So they've actually got a picture of a blue sunset.
Yeah. There are pictures. If you search for blue sunset on Mars, then you'll see lots of beautiful pictures.
And he's right, too. I did look it up, and it's very fetching. That's it for this month. Thank you to our guests, Ruth McNerney and Paul Workman, and also to the Chemistry World team, Neil Withers, Eleanor Richards and Philip Robinson. The production was by Meera Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith. We're from thenakedscientist.com, and we'll be back reacting to more cutting-edge chemistry for you next month. Until then, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org. We'll be right back.